In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for another Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Right now is part one of a very special Coolest Conversations we had recently in the Underground Garage when we celebrated Taj Mahal and Rai Cooter Week in honor of their upcoming release, Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee. In part one, I speak with Rai Cooter. In part two, Taj Mahal. Our coolest song in the world off the album is the track Hooray Hooray. So we'll hear a portion of that now, followed by my talk with Rai Cooter on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and to cap off our Rai Cooter and Taj Mahal week in the Underground Garage, I've got the great pleasure to speak with both of these exceptionally talented musicians and artists. Up first, and joining me now, is the guitarist, songwriter, composer, and producer, Rai Cooter. Hello, Rai, how are you?
I'm really good, Manfred. How are you doing?
I'm hanging in there, and I'm so excited to get a chance to talk with you, and of course, later with Taj. Now, we actually spoke in 2018, this was in the before times, before the pandemic. Did you and your family weather the past 2 years okay?
Oh, yeah, we have. We didn't have any problem, I'm happy to say. And we got vaccinated and still wearing masks indoors. But, you know, it's other than the fact that it changed what we do, me and Joaquin do professionally quite a bit. Health-wise, we're fine, but I have to say it's altered the landscape in terms of music quite considerably, right? I mean, Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, as everybody knows, I mean, you know.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you guys have kept healthy and with things kind of, using that phrase, getting back to normal, but you'd be able to get out on the in the road. I wasn't thinking of asking you this right now, but I'll go ahead. Do you guys, you and Taj, do you plan on doing any shows to promote the upcoming album?
Yes. Well, sure. What we're going to do is try a couple of nights in San Francisco at the Great American Music Hall in May. That's when the record is sort of released. You know, it's a funny thing to say released. There's some words. They're different now. It's, you know, everything's different. So, but anyways, being old timers. And we're going to do this and see how we like it and see how people what people think about it. Traveling isn't my cup of tea. I mean, I'm not happy in hotels and moving around and airplanes. Taj doesn't even fly anymore. He takes trains everywhere, which is part, you know, it's a good solution for him.
Yeah.
So we have to see about that, though. I mean, you get to be our age, and the traveling it's not the music itself. The show, as whatever it is, you sit on stage, you play your music. It's fun. It's nice. After all these years, you know, I feel like I'm doing so much better musically than before. But man, the rest of the 22 hours is a hell of a dang deal.
Yes, absolutely. It's like being a soldier, right? I mean, you drill, mm-hmm. practice, and then you do a lot of marching, and then the fight comes, and it's over before you know it. You know.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
I don't know. Well, we'll see. Yeah. You know, it would be nice to get out and play. It really would. And I like to play. I like to be on stage these days. When I was younger, I wasn't certain about it. I was undecided, but now I feel I'm okay and I'm going to get up there. I like what I'm doing, you know, in terms of the instruments. But we'll just see. Hopefully we can do it, you know, without having to knock ourselves completely out.
Well, we've been celebrating you and Taj all this week here in the Underground Garage with this upcoming release, Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee. Yeah. You mentioned your performance in May. They tell me that it's due out April the 22nd. You and Taj doing songs that Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee did during their many years of working together, some 40 plus years, I believe, around 45, that those guys were, you know, a pair recording and actively performing. Now, you and Taj's relationship, that goes back to the mid-60s. You guys were in the Rising Suns together, the band. Mm-hmm. There was one single that comes out, and then in 1992, an album of the unreleased material. Have you and Taj collaborated on any stuff since those mid-60s recordings?
No, not so much. I played some on his first Columbia record, his first record that he put out as a solo guy after the Rising Suns evaporated, but not since then. I've seen him here and there. You know, you run into people and everything. And then somewhere around pre-COVID, he and I started talking. I forget why. We just started talking and said, should we think about doing something together? You know, what would that be? It seemed like it might be a fun thing. I saw him at the Americana Festival down in Nashville at the Ryman. We played there together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it suddenly there was a question there. And so we didn't really proceed in any direction because COVID suddenly came and it was like everybody was running around like headless chickens. But then last spring, well, it's, let's see, around June, last June, you know, I was out watering the yard and it came to me. There's two of us, and Taj plays harmonica real well. I thought, well, what's a coherent thing if you had a repertoire in mind? You know, something specific, not just blues in general or music in general. That's too hard to put coherence around it. And then it popped into my head, you might say. It did, actually, somewhere after 20 minutes of watering the plants. And that I thought, Brownie and Sonny, you know, the repertoire is good. It's kind of upbeat. It's sunny and by that I mean breezy and nice. And the songs are good and fun to play. And I've been knowing those songs since I was a kid, really. And I knew that Taj did too. Like I called him up. I said, "How's this grab you? You know, the original Brownie and Sonny record, Get On Board, with the mysterious, elusive Coyle McMahon on maracas."
And I'm going to interrupt a second because I wanted to ask you about this guy because I went back and listened to those tracks, but I'll ask you in a moment. But I'm thinking about him. So that guy is on there, and you add and Taj Mahal do the same record.
Yes, and so he said, "Sure, let's try it," or something. You know, so we figured out we would do it. We would act in a similar way as musicians, you know. That is to say, you sit down and you sing and play. Very simply, very straightforwardly, and you don't need all kinds of. You don't need to do it. It shouldn't be. It needs a structural in an environmental context, similar to a Folkways record, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there when they were making those 10-inch Folkways LPs, but I always liked them. I mean, they had a kind of natural quality. So we did, and this is what we did. We went to my son Joaquin's living room, and he was our Coil McMahon, Joaquin was, and he played percussion. I'm not saying imitate the record, the original, or try to duplicate it in any way, but just invoke it. I mean, you see, and that style and those songs and rhythm and, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 play is about what it amounts to. I would say most of those tunes are one take, live vocals, you know.
Very cool.
Like you should be able to do at this age. I mean, for heaven's sake, yes, like, you know.
Well, like three tracks on that 10-inch, the Get On Board 10-inch from Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee, three of them, Midnight Special, Picabella Cotton, and I Shall Not Be Moved. You did versions of for the upcoming release. There are lots of terrific Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee recordings. How did you go about choosing the ones that wound up on the new album?
Well, you see, what happens is, and I know you know this, you get into a situation where you're recording, which is very different from other kinds of activities, right? I mean, it's not the same as a live show. It's certainly not the same as sitting around jamming, as they say, which I never like. I like to know that something's happening. It's going down, we used to say, on tape. And at that moment, you have to make decisions. You have to have some intuition about what's going to work or what's working, what's sounding good. So in a case like this, you have a repertoire going beyond that particular original record, of course. And you say, you know, they had this other tune. The heck was it? Anyways, but you let's try it. Right. I mean, you know, you it's like experimenting. You say, because I hadn't recorded with Taj in so long, 50 some odd years. I mean, heavens, gosh, it's amazing to think that's true. Yeah. So, but we're sitting there, you got earphones, Joaquin's there with his drums, and this living room, it's a great room for acoustic music. It's real, it has real tall ceiling, and if you don't play too hard and too loud, you get a beautiful sound. You get the room itself is very nice. It's good for singing. So I said, what sounds good in the earphones? We like the sound, let's try something. And then you do it, then you do another one, then you do another one. Pick the best ones, right? I mean, you know, and then that's your record. So yes, it's true that some of the tunes did not appear on the original Get On Board, but we act as though they did. We act as though this is our point of inspiration, you might say, and this is where we started from. Uh-huh. And then you listen back, you say, do we have a record here? And we kind of agreed that we did. I did a few overdubs, I will admit. Mm-hmm. Did a little harmony, put on another guitar part here and there. And then there's one where he sat down. I was having a cup of coffee somewhere in the house, and I heard him playing the piano. It was a piano in the room, beautiful Steinway, really good piano, high grade Steinway. And he was playing real well, a blues style thing. So I said, I know what to do. The mics are on. The engineer, Martin Prattler, said, yeah, all the mics are still on. So I ran in there, sat down, started singing. I didn't say to Taj, hey, I'm going to sing now. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, don't disturb the molecules that are in place on this. See? Right. Just fit yourself in and do it. And I did. I have the lyrics written out on to all the tunes I thought we might try in case I got stuck. So I was just reading it off the page. I'd never sung that song before in my life. Never even thought I would. You see? But that's the great thing about recording with this kind of. We didn't over prepare, and we didn't rehearse any of this either, by the way. That didn't happen. We just sat down and did it. And I like that best. You're going on pure instinct, and the enjoyment is fresh. As soon as you start thinking too hard and retaking and going on and on one song, you start to lose the, to me, you start to, I think, you start to lose the spontaneity, the quality of suddenly discovering something for yourself.
Right. You start kind of smoothing out the edges, you know.
We didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
We didn't want to do that.
Hopefully
people will say, oh, look, they're doing it pretty good, these old guys. Well, Joaquin's not old.
Well, let me ask you about,
but I mean, we're,
which, what song is this? Because I, on through the notes, I wrote down Piano Blues next to Deep Sea Diver. Is that the song you're talking about?
That's the one. Yeah, Deep Sea Diver. That's exactly right. They did that later. Brownie sang that. That was on another record.
Yeah.
Now, Taj liked it. He said he liked it. I think it was a popular R&B tune of the day. It's interesting to know where Brownie and Sonny got these songs from. They didn't write them. They weren't songwriters as such, but some of them were popular R&B tunes, late 30s, early 40s. Some were just folk songs, Pick a Bale of Cotton is Lead Belly, I guess. First time I ever heard it, I was probably 4 or 5 years old, on a Lead Belly record. Yeah, and so it occurred to me, said, well, who would sing Pick a Bale of Cotton anymore? I wonder if this is going to be, will people look askance? What were you thinking? You know, this is like, we're in a funny time now, socially and politically, right? I mean, you know, we're in a funny time. Things are becoming very fraught. And one thing I like about these songs is, man, they're just songs. They're just good songs. Can you dig that? I want to say to people, I hope they can. We don't have to put bookends of sociology around them. Do you see what I mean? We don't have to frame this at all in some narrative. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right. Well, I want to add about that song, Pick a Bale of Cotton. In my case, we were taught at an elementary school. Had like a music class twice a week, and we sang folk songs like Foggy Went Accordin', Jimmy Crack Corn, Pick a Bale of Cotton. And then thinking exactly about when I listened to y'all's version of it and the very issues you've mentioned, of course, that comes to mind too. But it's like, not only did Sonny and Brownie did it, it's like Sonny recorded a version with Woody Guthrie. You know, the songs have these lives that transcend, you know, sometimes what these perspectives that are attached to them, I think.
Yes. True.
So here, talking about Terry a little bit. Well, first, let me ask you, we should talk specifically about our coolest song in the world this week, Hooray, Hooray, because, you know, that's one we're playing a whole lot. And I found this online. I found there's a 1953 single version of the song. And I think this kind of plays back to what you were saying about Terry and Sonny and Brownie, you know, doing all kinds of different songs and then adapting them to the way they presented them. But it's a version of the song credited to Sonny Terry, and it's really rocking. There's electric guitar, piano, drums, as opposed to this.
That's a good one. I like that. That's what I heard too. I hadn't heard it other than that particular version. Yeah, it's good stomp. It's for sure good honky tonk, you know.
And so, did that recording figure into your decision to do the song, or influence the arrangement at all?
Yeah. Well, the arrangement was, they had a small band, but they had a nightclub, not a juke joint kind of band, which we didn't have at all. So we didn't have bass on Joaquin overdubbed his bass marimba as a bass, but he did as an overdub. So we were just going to go ahead sort of jug band style. Mm-hmm. That's what you might say, I guess, super jug band style. But the rhythm of the tune, I thought, well, I'm going to jump in here on mandolin. Mm-hmm. And because I can do that rhythm on mandolin better than I can do it on guitar. It gives it somewhat more emphatic pulse to it.
Yeah.
Also, I asked Taj, I said, didn't I play mandolin on your first record? He said, yes, it was the same mandolin, very same instrument. So let's hit it. You know, 1, 2, 3, play, bang, one take. You know, just good.
Very cool. One thing I hadn't realized when I was listening to your version of Pawn Shop Blues is that Blind Boy Fuller had done the tune. And then I was looking at stuff up and found out that Sonny Terry had played with him.
Yes.
you worked with Sonny on the soundtrack to the 1986 movie Crossroads. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And again, on Color Purple, Quincy Jones brought him back in on that one. They wanted some trained stuff, and I helped him there. But at that point, Sonny had gotten really old. And he was the same guy. I mean, same funny, terrific, warm-hearted guy, you know, same. His, at that moment, though, the you could tell his harmonica playing was down to train whistles. Yeah. That sort of faraway sound that the train, when you're like, say, 5 miles away from it, and you hear it come through the countryside making this whistle, that's about where he was at that point in his life. He couldn't do the very virtuoso stuff anymore, I don't think. But it was still him, though. You knew it was. So unique, you know, and it is an amazing character. It's a shame. It's a hell of a dang shame that nobody sat down and got his oral history, because he was a great talker too. He was, funny and very witty and an interesting person. And as far as I know, I never heard that anybody did. I wish they would have. It would have been nice to fill in some of the history there. He worked for so long, so many years, decades, right? I mean, we know him here, we know him there, like you say, Blind Boy Floyd. They actually recorded together, which I didn't realize. So the style was established, and Brownie stepped in when Fuller died, you know.
So when you mentioned Sonny, you know, being very, you know, open, talkative. Mm-hmm. Do you recall any stories that he said about working maybe with those guys from the earth? I know I'm putting you on the spot there. If you don't remember, that's fine too, but I have to ask.
I do one thing I know. There was, I don't know if this is right, but it's a funny story, because you see, at some point, Sonny and Brownie, they began to argue or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know what happened there, but I remember on stage at the Ash Grove in Hollywood one night, because they opened the Ash Grove, the club. They were the first act that Ed Pearl brought in, and subsequently brought them in several times. And I always went to see them, especially after I got my first car and my license. I could drive down, never miss a night, you know, and sit there at the bar around the stage a few feet away from them. Uh-huh. Which was incredible for a kid like me from South Santa Monica, where nothing ever happened at all, especially musically speaking, to jump in and just see these guys just bringing a whole world, another world right in front of me. I sit there, you know, and absorb it as much as I could. Well, anyway, Brownie tried some solo on the guitar, and they would sit in chairs because Brownie was, he had had polio, couldn't walk too well, and Sonny was blind. So, you know, they sat together and on the microphone. It was very Spartan in the Ash Grove, say the least. And Sonny turns to Brownie and say, "Man," you said, you're trying to play that thing like Blind Boy Fuller. You can't play that motherfucking thing like Blind Boy Fuller." It was off mic. I don't think the audience heard it, but I was sitting, you know, 5 feet away. I heard it. And I thought, whoa. So you see, there was, that's a historical footnote on blues guitar, right? There's something to that. I don't know too much about it.
Right. Well, you mentioned, Brownie having suffered from polio, and his brother Styx, and I had thought for I had just assumed for some reason that Styx was the older brother, but I found out no, he's actually the younger brother, and somehow younger brother, and got this nickname from working a stick, sort of like pushing a wagon, pulling a wagon that Brownie would sit in to help him get around easier.
And you
guys,
mm-hmm.
And you guys do a Styx McGee tune as I think the quintessential one. I mean, did lots of other recordings, but Drinking Wine, Spodeyote.
Yeah, big hit. It was a jukebox.
Yeah, big hit. I have a strange story. Yeah. Like somehow they had recorded it, and the some smaller label and the pressing was sold out. And then the guy, some distributor called up Atlantic Records and said, do you guys have this record? And the Jerry Wexler or Ahmet Ertegun, I think, said, no, but he remembered that he had Brownie McGee's phone number and called Brownie McGee, and the Styx was just happened to be in town. So they were just going to put air quotes here, recreate the record, but then they actually got a hold of him. When did you first hear it?
Well, probably there was an Atlantic Records R&B collection, the LP, at one point. I think it was a box set, a couple yeah. LPs that I had, and it was on there. It was, and I didn't know. There's, you know, gosh, I mean, the knowledge of these obscure things in music and the threads and all that, a person like me, you know, you might have the sporadic sort of bits and pieces of the story, unless you were there, you know. Yeah. I've picked up all, over the years, I've picked up all kinds of funny bits and pieces, but then I thought, well, Styx McGee must be, maybe he's Brownie's brother, maybe he's a relative. And sure, I didn't know. Nobody said anything. You know, you didn't have an opportunity, especially if you're from Santa Monica, to sit down. It's not like an uncle in Virginia up in the mountains that you see every day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, or in a small community, a tight little country community, and you know everybody's life story forwards and backwards. Well, I can tell you that you're from Santa Monica, you don't know anything. It's very difficult. Was it in those days?
Yeah.
We didn't have YouTube tutorials, and we did not have this reams of this of on the internet of mostly incorrect information, you know, 9 out of 10 times. But once in a while, you'd learn something. And so records were very educational. I know most of what I know from records. But their records are only a part of the story, see, because something is going on. Like, why? Who played on Johnny Cash's? Who played the sandpaper? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
I never found out. You know, I had to. We can go on that tip for a while. But the thing is, you have to then rely on yourself, your own ability, if you have any ability, or if you have some desire. It's mostly desire, I think, to learn the music that you like, right?
Yeah.
Secondhand. And so then you have to acquire some insight into it, hopefully from people. The insight comes from the people, not from the records. The records are mysterious. But then in the folk era of the 60s, we all started to see these people. They showed up for folk festivals, especially UCLA. They showed up at the Ash Grove. And then I started traveling a little and I began to see people. And it's a whole other, that's a whole other story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then blues, which is always African American, which was another world not open to me as a young white teenage kid, you know.
Yeah.
Why would anybody? Brownie was very, very friendly. I have to say, if I asked him, I'd say, see him in the hallway at the Ash Grove and say, can you show me this one thing you do on this song? Oh, sure, kid, he goes. He takes a guitar and says, it goes like this. He play a little thing that he did, a little passing thing, a little bass run or something that I wanted to know about. So that was lucky that time. You know what I mean? Or
cool.
You might say to Carter Stanley, you know, hey, Carter, what was that thing you did there? Most times, the musicians, very accommodative, very nice. You know, I always thought. They, you know, and I was shy. I mean, I didn't want to push in on people, for heaven's sake, you know, get up in their face or anything. But I always found musicians to be happy to show some young person what they wanted to know, you know, just so long as you didn't crowd them if they were eating or something, you know.
Right. Well, what got you, why did you specifically want to do the Drinking Wine Spodiote?
I hadn't thought of it. Well, Taj asked, do you think we could try it? I said, sure, we may be able to try it. But it didn't come up until he started playing piano. And that's when I thought, what'll fit? I had to make a quick decision before he stopped, because it wasn't a take. It wasn't like, I had been drinking coffee and talking to the engineer in another room where he had his speakers set up.
Yeah.
And I heard Taja playing this. He's playing it and it was good. And the sound was good and the piano sounded good in the room. I thought, well, what, think of something quick. Now do it. So I ran out there, grabbed my lyrics and went out there and sat in my chair. Those to have the same vocal perspective in the room, you see, and the mic was on and I started singing it, singing the thing. And it hadn't been planned at all. It just happened because he's playing the piano. You can tell that the tune fades up. It doesn't begin because it was midpoint that I had enough sense to get out there and start singing. You see what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
sure. now we're talking about deep sea diver, mm-hmm, yeah. Right? Right.
Right.
But with Drinking Wine Spodiote, was that Taj's idea as well to cover the song?
Yeah, he wanted to do Spodiote. He wanted to do it, but then we said, well, how are we gonna do it?
Yeah.
There's a lot of lyrics. Then Taj said, can he talk? He wanted to add, he asked me, is it okay if he talked it? I said, sure, do it any way you want. Let's just see.
Well,
and
I love that he
did it.
I love how he slipped in Boone's Farm in there.
Yeah.
I don't think that's in the original.
That's funny.
Yeah, that is very funny.
Boone's Farm is so terrible.
Yeah, I know. Well, it made me think of Mad Dog, you know. That's so I would have gone with Mad Dog, but I totally catch the Boone's Farm.
Boone's Farm.
Yeah, so amazing. There are a couple of spiritual numbers on the Get On Board, songs of Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee. Including What a Beautiful City and I Shall Not Be Moved. And the latter we're going to go out with in a moment. You know, Sonny and Brownie did a lot of spirituals. What is it about these two that sort of made the cut? Is there anything intrinsically about the songs?
Well, yes, of course. I Shall Not Be Moved is a great song. It's one of the best, I think, of in the Black Gospel. And it rocks. I mean, you can really, you get it going, you know, and the lyrics are good and the changes are good and it feels good to play it. And I sang it, played it with Mavis Staples and my other people as long as I can remember. So we all know it. We all know it real well. It's important that you, if you're going to record this way, where you haven't planned it so much and you haven't practiced it and you haven't rehearsed it, you should know the tunes. You should have this basic, they should be easy for you to call up. And so I Shall Not Be, of course, everybody knows. Beautiful City. I personally associate that song with Reverend Gary Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Brownie and Sonny did it. I know they did because I've got it here on an LP where they did a spiritual, a gospel LP. It's just a nice tune. I mean, it's a nice, interesting song. It's kind of slow. It's you can't hit the same lick tune after tune. You know, Brownie and Sonny, they did a lot of the songs the same way. That's the other thing I would say, that they had a format. I mean, Brownie had this figured out that toe tapping, happy up songs.
Yeah.
Are going to please the audience. And they were at that point, you know, singing for white audiences. They weren't singing for black audiences anymore. So, and he went to elocution school to clear up his Southern speech so that he could be well understood. Sonny would never have done that.
Yeah.
You know, but Brownie did. Brownie was thinking about this. I know that he was. He was looking into it and it worked. So, I mean, there's so many good gospel songs, but in that simple, we have to have simple tunes that me and Taj figured this out too. You know, we need to do the same thing. You might even say that Brownie and Sonny did. That is to say, keep it simple, keep it basic.
Right.
Let's not make it too obscure. I would like to do a record of Sleepy John Estes songs, but I know that 8 people would buy it and 4 would want their money back. It's too obscure. It's too hidden. You see?
Right. Well, that never stopped Taj Mahal. That never stopped Taj Mahal from recording Sleepy John Estes songs. He's done it quite as
well. I recorded
several
them too.
Of them.
Well, I did.
Yeah, well, right. Okay. Okay.
Me, I did. And so forth and so on. But nowadays you think, well, I wonder we need to hit it out of the park if we can. We need to blues is okay, and I like blues, and Taj is known for blues, but but when you make a record and you come out to the people these days, now in this moment in time, I feel that it should be easy and it should be fun. That's all. And that some people may think that's sounds trivial, but I don't think so. I think it's worthwhile. You know, it's a worthwhile idea. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
Some of Sleepy John's tunes are they're mostly about his own life. So you have to know something about that, and you have to know something about the life of poor working people in the 30s. Well, who wants to hear about that? You know, I did a lot of tunes from that era, and I like them very much. But I know that right now, in this time, these days and times, man, it's like, okay, let's help the people feel good if we can. Music's good for that, you know.
Right. Well, amen.
Public service, you know.
And you alluded to, or you mentioned his name, this Coyle McMahon earlier, and I noticed that on that original 10-inch, the Get On Board 10-inch from Sonny and Terry. Mm-hmm. That guy is on there playing maracas, and I think maybe he is. Well, he's at least playing maracas, and I Shall Not Be Moved. I can't recall. It seems like he's somewhere
singing bass too.
Singing bass. That's it. Singing bass. So, yeah. Do you know anything about this guy?
Nothing. Nobody does. But I can tell you that by the look of him in his tuxedo there, the only photograph that I know about. I'll bet you he was a church singer, choir singer, sang bass. He had a distinctive voice, very good, and he's a good rhythm singer, which bass is, you know, bass singing in that music style. The maracas, somebody probably put him in his hand. I bet Mo Ash of Folkway said, "Here, Coyle, play these," and it was a good addition. It was very good, and I like Browning and Sonny as a trio with Coyle better, and I like him as a duet. Well, so we've got Joaquim in there playing his esoteric and eccentric drum kit, but I added a bit of the Coyle bass singing as an overdub here and there just to keep the flavor populated a little bit more. So it's not quite so threadbare sounding, so it's not quite always the same, but that's Coyle's great. I mean, I'm a big Coyle McMahon fan. In fact, I'm a secretary treasurer and sergeant at arms of the Coyle McMahon Institute here in Altadena, and we have no members yet, but we're hopeful, you know.
Well, let me be the first to fill out my postcard and sign the application.
Send a dollar.
All right. As a Sazy, I'll send a self-addressed stamped envelope for you, and you can mail that
back.
That's right. Well, Rye, thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you. Good.
We're going to take leave of you now, and we're going to start a chat with Taj Mahal presently. But first, we're going to take a listen to y'all's version of I Shall Not Be Moved. It's Ry Cooter and Taj Mahal off Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. Like a tree planted by the water, I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved.
That was some of I Shall Not Be Moved from Taj Mahal and Ry Cooter here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Track is off the upcoming album Get On Board, the songs of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Ry Cooter for making part one of our Coolest Conversations so special. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. And please check out part two when I'll be chatting at length with Taj Mahal. It's your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.